Hey, listeners, on behalf of Vox Vignette here in Austin, thank you for downloading the podcast and being a part of our community, whether it be literally or indirectly. We also want to provide you with the opportunity to join in our mission. We are passionate about the work God has called us to, and the reality is there's a financial cost to that mission. In our first 4 years, we've been active, leading a church, starting and running Space 12, and managing two homes for intentional community. We are excited for what God has called us to, and want to invite you to partner with us. If you're interested and want more information, please go to voxaustin.com, where you'll find more about what's going on and how to get involved. If you'd like to partner with us financially, click on the giving link on the right side of the front page. Again, thanks for being a part of our extended community. We hope that the podcast has been a blessing, or at least a suitable sedative to you and your ears.
So maybe to get us started this morning, turn to someone. And I want to pose this question. What are your thoughts on individualism? And what do you think its effects on the church are? All right. Just some small questions to get us started. How do you feel about individualism, good, bad? And what are its implications on the church? Discuss. All right. Let's hear some thoughts. How do we feel about individualism? Good, bad? Anybody? Ambiguous, okay? Anybody else? Okay, did everyone hear that? So one of the gifts of Jesus is that he holds both the individual and the community together. And I should probably just let Fred speak. What do you think? I heard someone in the back there. Necessary for integrity. Good. Okay. What are its implications on the church then? What do we think about that? Pardon? It makes us insular. Okay. Excellent. Okay. It keeps us from seeing others with compassion. There was a hand right here. You're right behind the pole, Emily. That's like the cheap seat. Okay. So the language kind of affects how we think about our faith and our paradigm almost, right? And so this morning, I want to start a conversation on this. I don't know if any of you remember, I know John Bagwell does, but in the year 2000, Danny Boyle, pretty fresh off of Trainspotting, partnered with the king of the world and made a film called The Beach. You guys remember that? And so if you haven't seen it, it's based off of a book. I think Book Club might read it, but it basically goes like this. So we got our buddy Leo. He's now survived the ship, right? He's alive. And so he now goes, okay, it's not connected to Titanic, I'm just kidding. But he now goes to Thailand in search of this utopic island, right? Cannabis filled, white beach walking, blue water swimming. And so he finds it. And I found myself in the middle of this film. He gets to this island, and there's this thought that crosses my mind. Oh, man, I need to leave my job. I need to go find an island. I need to live this utopic life. Year 2000. Okay. 7 years later, there was a documentary that came out called Surfwise. Anyone see it? Okay. So the premise of this was there was this doctor, Stanford trained, living a stressful life as a doctor, and then leaves it all, moves him and his 9 children into an RV, and they live their life surfing. So halfway through this movie, I go, oh, I need to leave my job. I need to make 7 more kids. I need to live in an RV, and we're going to go surfing, right? And then I don't want to ruin either of these films for you because you should watch it. But in both these films, probably somewhere between 5 to 7 minutes of this thought incurring in my mind, it all like hits the fan and goes to hell. Like everything just falls apart. And so we see a lot of these films, we'll read these books, we have these experiences. And so we sometimes have this thought that, oh, these utopic communities don't exist. And therefore, like Fred was saying, we need to swing to this polar end of individualism. And this morning, I want to propose that maybe that's an insufficient answer, that there's a place for it, but as a community at large, with the mission we've been given, that it is so much harder to live life together, but it's better. It's so much harder to have our faith connected, intertwined. It's messier, but it's exponentially more beautiful. When we started this community in 2006, we sat down and we had a conversation. There were two ways we could go. We could be a program that people go to on Sunday, and there would be a certain way we could operate if that was the case. Or we could become a community that tries to live life together for 5, 10, 15 years and change a city. We chose the latter. It's been exponentially hard. There's been moments in these last few years where I'm like, good God, we should have just put together a program, right? But it's been so much more rich, full of life. And this morning, and next, this coming Wednesday, and next week, I want to talk about that. What would it look like if we fought for the ideals of community, if we fought to live life and our faith together? So we're going to be in Ephesians, just a little background. It was a very kind of bourgeois type city. It was very well-to-do. It had a very creative ethos to it. It attracted a lot of artisans, a lot of craftsmen. Ephesus was about 250,000 people. They had a stadium that could fit 25,000. They had, this is impressive, indoor toilets, running water. And they were living in this culture where religion was very consumeristic. It was based on fertility. They had a god that was the goddess of fertility. It was based on castrating yourself, picking up prostitutes, and earning your right to earn the respect of the god so that you could have more children. And so this was the culture that they were living in. And then Paul, while in prison, writes this letter. So this week, next week, we're going to be in chapter 4. So go ahead and read 1 through 6 together with a neighbor, and then we'll walk through it. All right, Ephesians chapter 4, go. All right, let's pick this up in verse 1. He says, therefore, I, as a prisoner serving for the Lord, so he's literally writing this from prison. He says this, I beg you, and when in scripture you see you, it's plural, you all, I beg you all to lead a life worthy of your plural calling. And so just off the bat, you know, what is our collective calling together? What is your calling in life, and how does it fit together with us, all of us? And he says, now in light of that, okay, we've got this collective calling together, okay? And he reminds us, for you have been, there is this call. And then he gives this very non-American kind of sentiment, right? Always be humble and gentle, right? Be patient with each other, making allowance for each other's faults. So he says this, okay? He's like, there's this calling that we have, plural, all of us. In light of that, live up to that calling, okay? So it starts now. Collectively, we've been given a calling. Then he says this, make every effort to keep yourselves united in the Spirit, binding yourselves together with peace. For there is one body, one Spirit, just as you've been called to one glorious hope for the future. This is your calling. There's this beautiful, glorious hope. There is one Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father who is over all, in all, living through all. Okay, this is what he's saying. So collectively now, there's this call, right? For us, there's this call to be a church, call to this city. Now, in light of this collective calling, live in a certain way. Then he says this now. Now that we've been called, unify yourselves. Don't be separate agendas. Don't be a collection of different people with different voices. Be one. Fight to be unified. Okay? And I think this is interesting because there's kind of this ironic posture to, at least when I hear this, because I think our generation and a lot of us in this room, we've seen the effects of hyper-individualism. And so we're trying to build communities. We want walkable neighborhoods. We want human interaction, right? And actually, we like the unification of things. We like to organize. We like organized activism. We like organized farming. We like organized crafting. We like organized cycling. We like organized, just name it. We enjoy this idea of coming together, organizing behind a call to something, right? But I would say out of all those things, probably the one thing, if I say it, will have a negative reaction would be what? Organized religion. And I want to offer that that is okay, right? I think our adverse reaction to organized religion, I understand that. But I would say as a church then, if there is this call, and now if there is organized religion that we're rejecting, what will be our alternative to that? We have to provide an alternative. And maybe it's like this. Maybe we reject organized religion because it's the organization of faith for self-gain and self-preservation. I don't know if that's a good thing. But maybe we need to organize our faith so our collective talents, gifts can be given away to the world. Maybe it's like this. So a couple weeks ago, we got back from our holidays. Our family was up in the Pacific Northwest. And then we came back, and there was this news that our school received that just kind of shook the foundation of our whole community. And Sam's on the campus advisory board. I'm on the district advisory board. So we had heard rumors that there might be school closings, there's going to be budget cuts. But when we came back, it was released to the press on Tuesday, announced to the school, and then they called a public hearing. And so we've been, in the last couple weeks, neck deep in that. So my kids go to Ortega Elementary, which is down the street. Oak Springs Elementary, which is the closest elementary school to here. 80% of the parents are unemployed. They're also proposed to be closed. And so this is my general understanding of it. So there's budget cuts. Everyone's cutting, okay? They now put together a task force, and their job was now we need $50 million. Find it somehow. And so the strategy and the road that they've gone down is let's look at the age of school buildings without really taking into consideration performance or the neighborhood of the school, and then let's find the oldest schools that cost us the most money, and then let's just cut it. The problem with that now is they're proposing to close 9 schools. 6 out of those 9 are minority schools. 7 out of those 9 are high-achieving schools, exemplary schools. In the case of Oak Springs Elementary, which 80% of the parents are unemployed. It's in the lowest income zip code in the city. It's across the street from the largest housing project in the city. They fought, teachers fought so hard to finally make it exemplary, and they're now proposing to shut it down. In our school, our principal, Dr. Pedrosa, worked for years, took the school from a 3 to a 4 to a 5. It's now a 9 out of 10. It's one of the highest achieving schools in East Austin. They're now proposing to shut it down. They would now move our school into a low-performing school. Our kids, who a lot of them walk to school, would have to walk across Airport and Springdale. The school that they're proposing to move them into, it would be immediately over-enrolled. So that's the proposal on the table. So when we heard that, right, we were upset, we were distraught, we didn't know what to do. They called a public hearing on Wednesday at the Delco Center. When I was driving back, Karen and I were in the car, Sam was in the car, Joshua and Hannah, and we were talking, what should we do? For me, when I first heard this, I'm like, you know, this is maybe why God brought us into this community. We need to be here. If we go down, we'll go down fighting. And so we just throw, you know, what can we do? At that time, there were 9 schools shouting on their own, and then Sam and I just started talking. We need to organize. We need to bring these schools together, and a unified voice will be stronger than 9 separate voices shouting their own agenda. And then on Wednesday, Mr. Sam Lee, our own Sam Lee, called this meeting. Check out the clip.
To closing those 9 Central City schools, the alternatives include selling other district facilities. Parents are continuing their fight. KXAN's Jared Wise joins us live here in the studio with more. Jared?
Well, Robert, most parents we spoke to tonight were just handed those new options this evening, options that include eliminating school portables, saving on electricity, and terminating leases on a number of facilities and parking lots around the city, including the $29 million AISD headquarters on West 6th. But as you heard, because school closures could still be a possibility, parents aren't backing down, and they believe there is still strength in numbers.
I think it's wrong.
Most of the kids and parents in this East Austin neighborhood have one thing in common.
We don't want Oak Springs to close down.
And I think they should keep it open because it's right here in the neighborhood.
Oak Springs Elementary is one of the 9 schools under the potential AISD chopping block. And it sits right across the street from a housing project. And not only provides a place for children to learn, but for the community to gather.
Like here is low income. I mean, they should keep it open. And that way the parents don't got to suffer through the money-wise.
We want to hear from all the schools what you have been doing.
Just about a mile away, teachers and parents representing all 9 schools in the district came together to brainstorm.
For us, our problem is we don't agree with any of the numbers they propose.
And together try to remove all those 9 schools from that list.
You'll find some great ideas that other schools have done that you might want to do as well.
The group was organized by this man. Sam Lee is an Ortega Elementary school parent.
We want to have a unified voice, and we feel like the more support we get from all the schools, the stronger initiative and support we get from everybody.
Last week's public forums were a chance for the parents to speak to officials, but this is the first time they've had a chance to mingle with each other and gain ideas about how to forge on.
We could organize better together, plan more rallies together, and ultimately just be able to say, hey, we all support some certain plans and feel like that's a stronger front than each individual school.
For that meeting tonight, urban schools, and a statement to the school district was drafted on behalf of all 9 schools that could include further discussion on closing alternatives. Now, coalition members plan to speak directly to school board members at the scheduled school board meeting next Monday. A final list of recommendations by the task force is expected in March, with a vote by board members March 28th. Live in the studio, Jared Wise, KXAN, Austin News.
So, Sam Lee, let's give him a hand. Yeah, well done. And I think we would see a task like this, and there is no hesitancy in organizing because there's too much at stake, correct? And I would say this, if the agenda of our faith is for us and our own comfort and our own lives, you're right, we can live it alone. But if there's a world that's broken, in need, and there now is supposed to be the hands and feet of Christ, there should be no hesitancy in us coming together. We need to organize. There's a guy by the name of Nehemiah in Scripture, and he had risen to the ranks of, you know, his country. He was a child of an immigrant. His parents had moved 150 years earlier because of war. They were now in another culture, another place. As immigrants, he receives a good education. He's now a cupbearer to the king. And one day now, he's living in the palace, miles and miles away. And he hears the stories of his own people, war-torn, living in poverty, unorganized. And he breaks down weeping. And he now leaves the palace, walks back, and does what no one could do in 150 years. He brings together leaders, priests, mayors, governors, and they rebuild the city. And I think what a beautiful, beautiful picture for the church. Organized religion for self-preservation, you're right, that's not great. But organized faith for us sent out to the city, I think, is a non-negotiable. Last Wednesday and this coming Wednesday, we're going to talk about these communities where church historians say that about every 400 years, there's like a big shift in church history. And in the big change, there's these movements on the fringe that organize together. They develop a rule of life. The Franciscans did it, the Dominicans did it, the Augustinians did it, the Jesuits did it. And over these 400 years, they're a response to the needs of the world, response to the abuses of the church. They organize to live a certain way together, and they change the world around them. And so last Wednesday we started it. This coming Wednesday we're going to continue it, and we're going to say, hey, there's so much talent. We've been called to this city. If we were to organize to live in a certain way, what would that way of life look like? All right, let's pick the story up. So he goes on now, okay? So he talks about how we're unified. There's one Lord, one faith, one baptism. We're collectively together because there's something we're called to, okay? Then he takes a shift in verse 7. He says, now within this organization, within this unity, he says, however, he has given each one of us a special gift. The word there is literally grace. It's something we don't deserve. It's like a present, but a talent we've been given through the generosity of Christ. Now, Eugene Peterson says it like this. But that doesn't mean, because you're unified, that you should all look and speak and act the same. Out of Christ's generosity, right, each one of us is given his or her own gift. And then he goes on and talks about how Christ now has ascended, and he's left us with these gifts. Christ ascends, and now we're imparted to do what Jesus would on this earth. And then in verse 11, he talks about different roles. Apostles, which are entrepreneurs and people who start movements. Prophets, who are the activists, the evangelists, the communicators, the pastors, the people who care and shepherd, the teachers. And he said their responsibility with all this diversity in the church now, okay, is to equip them, to build them up, and then this will continue until we have such unity in our faith. So this is where Paul's going. He says, we have this calling. Now live up to that collectively. Okay, it's a collective calling. Now we're unified. Within that unity, there's a diversity of background, of experience, of talents. And for me, this is helpful because sometimes, like, I think diversity, it's really important, but it's so often talked about. It's kind of trendy, right? This past week, there was MLK. It was such an important day. Like, I was looking up his life on Monday, and it's mind-boggling. He won the Nobel Peace Prize when he was younger than me. He passed before the age of 40, and to see how much he did, and then you think about how much work there still is to do. But I started thinking about diversity, and it's a buzzword, right? Sometimes when I think about it, there's this sense that diversity, it's kind of like telling kids to eat vegetables, right? So I have this conversation with my six-year-old son. Son, you can't only eat brown food. You can't just have pancakes, syrups, chocolate, hamburgers, pizza, cheese pizza, chocolate, syrup, right? You can't have a full diet. You're going to die, right? That's what I tell him. So we have this conversation. You have to eat different colors. That's what they teach you now, right? You have to have red stuff and orange stuff and green stuff, and then occasionally, and then he's like, but then it all comes out brown, right? Like, that's a good point. But sometimes there's this sense, like when I'm talking to him, it's like, it's important. You got to eat vegetables. You might not enjoy it, but it's good for you. And I feel like sometimes when we talk about diversity, sometimes it's in that posture. Like, it's going to be hard. Your ignorances are going to come up with others' ignorances, and then we're going to collide, and we got to figure out how to live life together. And it's going to be hard, but it's good for us, right? And there is that element. There is that sense to it. But that's a really bottom line way of thinking about it. But I like what Paul does because he kind of gives us a vision now, right? Because he's saying we're called to something. There's this collective calling. And as we're called to something, we have to unify. We have to organize. But within that then, if there's a call to something, the diversity of your experiences, the diversity of your talents, the diversity of your background is necessary. We need it. Like when Sam was organizing all the schools, we need someone who's connected to the media. We need someone who's administrative. We need someone who can rally people. We need people who can translate, do different languages. And the diversity of gifts and talents, because of the mission, becomes important. I would say the same for Box. As we're called to the city, we need artists, but we need teachers. We need social workers. We need administrators. We need policymakers. We need small business owners. We need engineers. We need the whole gamut because there's this calling that we're brought to together, right? Maybe like a good picture of this would be like a musician, right? So you can have a singer-songwriter who sings by themselves, but then if there's a song that brings together other musical talents, other instruments, then as each one comes along, the song becomes more and more beautiful. Anyone a fan of Beirut? Zach Condon, the band? There's this clip that shows him singing alone, and then he picks up band members. And I think it's a great picture for the church. Check it out.
The It's been a long time now since I've seen you smile, and I'll gamble away, my friend. Oh, I'll gamble away my time, and in a year or a year or so, this will slip into the sea. But it's been a long time, a long time now since I've seen
beautiful, right? That there's this sense that we can sing alone, but maybe we've been given this song with different instruments and different talents and different backgrounds and different education, and as we come together collectively, we're sent out as this orchestra, as this symphony to the world around us. And then let's finish up here. So he keeps going now, right? And he says there's this diversity of gifts. And then there's talents. And then he says, all this then is so that we grow together. There's this maturation process. Verse 14, we will no longer be immature like children. We won't be tossed and blown about by every wind of new teaching. We will not be influenced when people try to trick us with lies so clever they sound like truth. Instead, we will speak truth in love, growing in every way more and more like Christ, who is the head of his body, the church. He makes the whole body fit together perfectly. As each part does his own special work, there's a diversity. It helps other parts to grow so that the whole body is healthy and growing and full of love. And there's this picture, right? We're called to something. Christ now gives us its diversity of gifts. We're organized together. And then as Christ, as the head, we all grow and develop in our own part. But that helps other people develop and grow. And I'll just finish off with this. In terms of our spiritual formation, what does growth look like for you? In the past 2-3 years, how have you grown and what have you done to grow? What is your plan? How do we go about doing that? There's this book by the name of Talent is Overrated. The author's name is Jeff Colvin. Anyone read this? But the premise of this book is basically, he says, you see great people, they do amazing things. And usually the assumption is two things. They're either just born with it, they're just more gifted, or they're hardworking. And he says those are probably the two most common assumptions, but he says that the data doesn't support it. And he says what really defines people who are great and grow in their craft, he calls it deliberate practice. And he says deliberate practice, there's a few elements of this. He says deliberate practice is designed, okay? There's like a specific plan. He says Tiger Woods takes a golf ball, goes to a sand trap, stomps on it, and then he just tries to hit it out of that sand trap thousands of times. In one season, he might come across that hit like once or twice, but because he's practiced it thousands of times. I remember Barry Bonds talking about his dad's a baseball coach. His dad would take tennis balls, golf balls, draw a number on it, and then pitch it at him. Barry Bonds would call out the number on the golf ball and then hit it. And he said, practice, there's a design. It's deliberate. He said, that's the first part. Then he says, there's repetition. Okay? There's just severe repetition. He talks about Chris Rock and Jerry Seinfeld. When they piece together a two-hour set, it's them now repeating one joke in these small, tiny clubs over and over. He said this repetition now involves a high rate of failure, and now you need to determine what works, what doesn't. He says another element, you have design, you have repetition, you have feedback. To have a coach, a mentor, a teacher to give you feedback on how things are going. And then he says the last part then is setting goals, right? And I just thought that was interesting because when I was reading that, and at the same time I was reading about these communities, these monastic communities, who put together a rule of life, and it was like these communities did the same thing, and they just gathered and said, we've got this mission, but there's a growth process. What does growth look like for us? I'll give you two examples. Here's one contemporary community that's in Europe right now. I think they have Franciscan roots. This is their rule of life. He says this. One is keep the word holy. Use only words to give glory to God. Speak not except when necessary or at prayer. Number two, seek the heavenly gift of contemplation alone in your cell. This isn't prison. They have rooms. When in common with the brothers. Number three, pray for the gift of tears. Cleanse your soul from sin through penance and denial. Number four, at all times, dress simply, whatever station you have in life. Number five, hold everything in common, whatever little or much the brothers hold in common, let it be at the command of the senior brother. Number six, be always naked in the imitation of Christ. Number seven, live the Gospels daily and follow in the footprints of Christ. Number eight, dwell on this earth as pilgrims and strangers. Let your dwelling be modest in size and construction, and a house and only clothing necessary. Number nine, eat what is set before you. Share your food with the poor. Number 10, confess your sins before the brothers every week. Number 11, pray often for those who trouble you and for your enemies. And I like number 12, sleep only when your body demands rest. Okay? That's one community. Here's another contemporary community. It's a group, it's a movement called New Monasticism. And this is their way of life. This is their way of deliberately growing, practicing together. Number one, relocation to the abandoned places of the empire, at the margins of society. Number two, sharing economic resources with fellow community members and the needy among us. Number three, hospitality to the stranger. Number four, lament for racial divisions within the church and our communities, combined with the active pursuit of a just reconciliation. Number five, humble submission to Christ's body and the church. Number six, intentional formation in the way of Christ and the rule of the community along the lines of the old novitiate. The novitiate is when you come into a monastic community as a novice, and then when between a novice and a monk, you are a novitiate. Number seven, nurturing common life among members of an intentional community. Number eight, support for the celibate singles alongside monogamous married couples and their children. Number nine, geographical proximity to the community members who share a common rule of life. Number 10, care for the plot of God's earth given to us along with the support of our local economies. Number 11, peacemaking in the midst of violence and conflict resolution. And then number 12, commitment to a disciplined contemplative life. And so these are examples. These are communities throughout history who have had a deliberate common rule. And so this past Wednesday, we started it. If you didn't make it, join us this coming Wednesday. And we just want to ask, what does that common rule of life look like for Vox in our context? And then how are we going to grow together so that we can serve the world around us? So Leonardo DiCaprio is on this utopic beach, and he's swimming. He's falling in love with attractive women. He's sleeping in the sand. They're playing volleyball. And then at some point, I won't ruin this for you. Although, if you haven't seen this, you've had 11 years. You should. So it all goes to hell. They leave the island. He is now in Thailand. And he wanders into an internet cafe. And then someone sends him this picture. And it's this picture of the whole group in this utopic community. And they're all like, it's like a group picture. And it was like at the high point of their community. And then their friend writes this attached to the picture. I have the quote up there. "Of course, you can never forget what we have done, but we adapt. We carry on. And me, I still believe in paradise. But now at least I'll know it's not some place you can look for, because it's not where you go, but it's how you feel for a moment in your life when you're a part of something. And if you find that moment, it lasts forever. And I want to propose for our community to be that something and to fight for that something and to be the church in this world." Let's pray together.